first case for argument this morning is United States by and through Maine against Oakland City University. Scarborough.
May it please the court.
Charles Scarborough for the United States of America, in support of the appellant. This case involves allegations that Oakland City University knowingly made false promises to comply with a statutory condition on the receipt of federal student loan and grant funds, the ban on paying incentive compensation to student recruiters. The district court in this case held that OCU's false statements in required program participation agreements were not actionable under the False Claims Act because they were not direct claims for government funds. This was error because the False Claims Act does not merely prohibit direct false claims, but instead broadly prohibits knowing false statements that cause the government to pay out money. As this court recently recognized in the Lammers case, the False Claims Act requirements of having a false claim is satisfied when the defendant made a record or statement in order to get the government to pay out money. The record or statement was false or fraudulent, and the defendant knew that it was false or fraudulent. There's no real dispute in this case that OCU's false promises of compliance with the incentive compensation ban in its PPAs were made in order to establish and maintain its eligibility to receive Title IV funds, and that these statements caused various claims for funds to be presented to the government, both by students and OCU itself.
Is there a hierarchy of importance in these PPA claims? Some are more important than others.
I don't think so. I don't think you could develop a hierarchy. I think there are some conditions that might not cause the government and the Department of Education in a particular case to go out and terminate your participation in the program. But for the most part, if they are in the program participation agreement, they may, in appropriate circumstances, be cause for termination, in which case the school can no longer receive any funds in the program.
This incentive recruiting thing seems to be fairly important, I would think.
Yes, sir.
So my question really is it more important than most of the things, or just where do you put it?
Sure. I would say it goes to the very heart of the program here. I mean, the reason why Congress instated the incentive compensation ban was because in 1992 there were problems with fraud and basically people going out and recruiting students who weren't qualified. And if a student comes in who's not qualified and is paying an exorbitant tuition rate, he's more likely to default on the student loans, and the government is more likely to get hit at the back end for a tab. So yes, I really characterize it as sort of going to the core of how the program operates. But as to whether it's more important than any other given requirement, I'm reluctant to say, because I think that goes to the Department of Education's enforcement discretion, in any given case. Now, as to that discretion, we've included in the back of our brief a policy memorandum in which the Department of Education states that generally it will not treat violations of the incentive compensation ban as causing loss to the government. And the defendants sort of say, well, this means, of course, you're not generally going to treat this as a very bad thing. But really, we think the memo confirms the important thing is that they do very much have the legal authority to terminate participation in the program, which terminates the flow of funds to this school. Because if you can't participate in the program, as the legislative history of the False Claims Act makes clear, then when you submit a claim under that program, you have submitted a false claim. And really, the court need go no further than that sort of basic analysis that there was a false statement at the front end to procure eligibility to participate in this program, and that caused money to start flowing from the government to students and ultimately to the school. And that's enough in and of itself for False Claims Act liability. There are other theories, implied certification, promissory fraud, that might also work in this case. But really, the court needs to go no further than the fact that there was an express false statement at the front end that got them eligibility to participate, and then there were claims submitted on the back end, and they caused loss to the government. And that's really the basic analysis that we think the court really needs to reverse the district court's erroneous notion that the fact that there was no direct claim to the government is a prohibition on False Claims Act liability. There is no direct claim requirement. All there is a requirement that a false statement be made that causes the government.
Has this question arisen in any other circuit?
It will be before the Ninth Circuit in a case called Hendow, which is cited in our briefs and in the defendant's briefs. It has come before the Fifth Circuit, which affirmed a decision that we think is wrong, but affirmed it in an unpublished decision. So there is no precedent in the Fifth Circuit on this point. It's an unpublished decision. But this is a very important issue. The reason why the government is here.
But I didn't take the bottom line, Bob. I'm sorry. Take it, your bottom line is no.
Yes, my bottom line is no. Your last question. Okay. Sorry.
Why didn't the government take this case originally?
I'm not sure, Norman, and I'm not sure even if I do know that I would be able to tell the court. There's a variety of reasons for declining to exercise, to come in and take over in a False Claims Act case. The bottom line rule there is that no inference should be drawn by the government's failure to participate or not. The reason why we're participating now in appeal is that the district court's direct claim requirement really is something that would undermine sort of False Claims Act liability in any government program in which there are required statements that need to be made on the front end to obtain eligibility or to obtain a contract. And then the funds start flowing, and then the actual claim, there's nothing false in the actual claim, but there's a false statement at the beginning, and that's a very important issue, sort of aside from this particular regulatory scheme that we need to have corrected here. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Scarborough. Mr. Seisky.
Thank you. May it please the court. I briefly would just like to reiterate what Mr. Scarborough has already argued to the court, and that is the importance of this incentive ban on paying commission to recruiters. In 1991, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations looked into fraud and abuse within the federal aid, student aid programs, and what they found was a correlation between paying recruiters commission bonus and high default rates with student loans.
Excuse me, what are you talking about? Is there some statute other than the False Claims Act that you're talking about?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Senate subcommittees don't count. If Congress enacts and the President signs some legislation, we'll be happy to interpret it. But we don't interpret subcommittee hearings. They aren't a source of law.
Thank you, Your Honor. The import is that there is a high correlation between paying the recruiters commission bonus and default rates. And in the record, one of the program participation agreements that Oakland City executed details that they had a high default rate on their student loans. Because of this situation, in 1992, the Higher Education Act was amended to add the incentive pay provision. So Oakland City, in this case, by its conduct, frustrated the very purpose of the 1992 amendment. In this case, Oakland City maintains that there is a distinction between fraudulently or falsely enrolling into a program and falsely or fraudulently making a claim for payment. What this would result if the position was accepted is situations where you have, for instance, someone representing that he or she is a veteran and enrolling into a veteran's funding program and then submitting a valid medical bill versus a situation where a person is in fact a veteran and then later submits an invalid medical bill. Okay, which situation is less fraudulent? Well, there isn't a difference between the two, but that's exactly what Oakland City maintains is the case, that fraudulent or falsely enrolling into a government funding program is less fraudulent than submitting an invoice for a claim for payment.
Are there any questions? Thank you. I'd reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. McManus.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. May it please the court. Michael McManus, along with Jonathan Turnow and James Johnson, on behalf of Oakland City University. This case is fairly straightforward and non-complicated. The government and the relator in this case are advancing simultaneously three theories on which they contend False Claim Act liability should be imposed on my client in this case. The first is that there was a direct claim made on behalf of Oakland City to the government, resulting in payment to the government. They claimed that this was done through the PPAs. That is just
through the what?
The PPAs, the Program Participation Agreement.
If you would use English, it would be a help to those of us who are not specialists in your assorted acronyms.
Yes, sir. Through the Program Participation Agreements, two of which are part of the supplemental materials in this case. The False Claims Act defines claim to be a request or demand to the government for payment. Program Participation Agreements do not result in any payment to the government at any time.
But you never got in the front door without an accurate, honest PPA.
That may be correct, sir, but I'd like to take these in order, if you don't mind, and that is the third branch of the...
No, I think you want to answer Judge Evans' question.
That is the but-for argument that is raised by the government. And Your Honor asked the question before, is there a hierarchy in the importance of these matters? I believe that the answer, according to the record and according to the Department of Education, is clearly yes. The program participation agreements are divided into various segments, one of which is a segment that requires certification for certain things. Requires certification that a university has a drug abuse program and other things like that. Violation or false certification or failure to certify, specifically according to the program participation agreements and the regs, can lead to termination as a result.
This one seems to be a pretty important requirement, this incentive for paying recruiters to get people to come to your school. That just doesn't sound very good to me.
I would suggest to you, sir, that does not in any way, though, impose False Claims Act liability, and that the Department of Education has made that clear. The government, The memo is also part of the record, sir, from the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Education 2 years ago, Mr. Hansen, in which he directed the department to recognize these types of alleged violations as administrative issues. And he specifically said in that document that these types of violations do not result in a monetary loss by the government. And that's the whole heart of the False Claims Act, is that the government loses money through some
sort of... I think you omitted the word ordinarily. It's going to be, if we reverse, a separate item that the plaintiff is going to need to prove to show loss.
That is correct, sir.
But it's not clear to me why difficulty in tying a particular fraud to a monetary loss should kick the case out at the threshold.
Well, because the purpose of the False Claim Act from its inception was to prevent, as Your Honor knows, when it was originally enacted by Congress.
I understand that, but suppose some defense contractor fraudulently certifies that goods have been inspected and puts them in jets, right? And that's false. It turns out the goods were perfectly good, so the lack of inspection didn't hurt, but somebody went and inspected. Would it be the difficulty of proof and the fact that the contractor had furnished, good parts, be a defense to a False Claims Act suit based on the fraud and the certification that they've been inspected?
I believe that it may, and I believe that under the circumstances in this case...
Well, that answer is just flat wrong. I mean, that's an established point, right? And if your position is the same as that, then that is the difficulty of proof of showing damages not to claim out.
It is not.
But that's the argument you're now making. This memo has to do with difficulty of showing damages. But our case doesn't concern the difficulty of showing damages. Not now.
No, sir. And I would respectfully suggest to you, sir, that memo does not simply deal with proof of damages. The money procured and dispersed by the Department of Education is specifically, according to all the regs that are part of this record, for use by the students, the individual students, for their education. The funds. The funds do not flow to the student.
What we've got is a two-stage system in which both the student and the university have to be individually eligible. And each has to do something to certify his eligibility. And your position seems to be, indeed this is how I read the district judge's decision, that any such two-stage certification, fraud is okay, because one can always say, but for the other certification that somebody else made, there would have been no funds, and therefore my certification isn't really important and can be disregarded, even if it's fraudulent. And I wonder whether that can be so.
When you consider the purpose of what the money is to be used, sir.
How about if we just consider the text of the statute?
Yes, sir.
What is your argument rest on in the text of the statute?
The text of the statute requires that the defendant in the case submit a demand or claim for payment from the government and that that be false. That's not what we have in this case.
Do you think the statute itself imposes a one-document rule so that in two certification or two-document cases, there can't be any claim? But why do you think the statute is imposing a one-document
rule? I don't believe that. I believe that the term meaning of the statute is that courts, as you all know, have extrapolated and extended that through a pass-through sort of implication of the False Claims Act. That's not what we have here. And what we have here is a
I'm lost. I have no idea what you mean by a pass-through interpretation.
One of the arguments that the government has made about anything passing through, one of the arguments that the government has made is that OpenC can be held liable for causing someone else to submit a false claim. That's one of the arguments that Mrs. Scarborough mentioned. That's one of the arguments that's in there.
But it's not the question I'm asking right now.
The answer that the court needs to focus on is the fact that the money in this case is being used for the education of the student, and there is no allocation that the government has suffered loss because, for example, money was paid for ineligible students, money was paid for students that didn't enroll, money was paid for students that shouldn't have been given access to the money. That's where any potential loss to the government comes. It has not even been alleged in this case. So it's not necessarily a question of damages. It's a question of what does this complaint say? And yes, sir, I would submit to the court that when you have this specific factual situation, there is no factual element that allows implication of the False Claims Act upon Oakland City. Nothing that Oakland City did, according to the complaint, the arguments raised by the relator and by the United States, indicates in any way that the government suffered a loss because the monies weren't appropriately used. That's simply not alleged in this case. And so if the money was in fact used for its intended purposes, there cannot be a False Claims Act. And again, I go back to the very genesis of the act. It was to protect the government from fraudulent losses. And the original intent of the statute was to not have the government pay for a full barrel of gunpowder when the contractor was putting a little weapon by them and really only submitting a half a barrel. And that's the language, Your Honor, asked about the language of the statute, and I would submit to you that that is what the statute says on its face. And if you're going to make the set that there is a two-step argument, then you must consider the fact whether or not the money that was appropriated in these cases, in fact, was not spent fully or completely for its intended purpose. In other words, whether or not there was an initial mistake or error or even fraud, and I was admitting there was no fraud here, in filling out the program participation agreement initially, there is no way that you would have a but-for argument that says the government somehow lost money because as a result of that, the government's money was not spent on the education of these students.
And that's the whole purpose. If you, that's run throughout the regulations that are part of this case. The money is to be spent for the education of the students. And if that is done, and there's no allegations to the contrary in this case, then the government has not lost money, has not suffered any loss, has not been defrauded. Unless there are any other questions, I thank you for your time and attention.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Scarborough?
Say something further when things are seemingly going well, but I'm hearing this point about the text of the statute. I would just like to suggest that the case can be resolved very simply under the text of 31 U.S.C. 3729A2, which provides that liability under the False Claims Act when a defendant knowingly makes, uses, or causes to be made or used a false record or statement to get a false or fraudulent claim paid or approved by the government. And this is precisely, we're talking about a false statement at the front end that causes claims to be submitted and money to be paid out by the government. That's the textual.
Yeah, well, of course, that's also your weakest point, because the student's claim, I'm enrolled, is not false or fraudulent. The student's claim is true.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right? And the statute says false record or statement to get a false or fraudulent claim paid. It doesn't say false record or statement to get an honest claim paid.
What makes the claim for funds from the government, the actual claim submitted, the mechanisms vary under these different programs. Sometimes it's the students, sometimes it's the students in the schools jointly submitting claims. What makes the sort of the thing that is submitted to the government requesting money false is the fact that the school is not eligible itself. And this is reflected in the legislative history. I know we're not interpreting legislative history, but the legislative history of the False Claims Act, which is included at the appendix at 86, is quite clear that a claim may be false, even if the services are provided, as where a defendant is ineligible to participate in the program. This is precisely what is going on here. The threshold issue is, as in Cicero, is whether the government would have let the school participate in the program, would have given them an ID number by which they could receive federal funds had they not made the false statement in the program participation agreement. And really, we're talking about threshold allegations at this point about what is necessary to state a false claim, whether it's material, whether it's knowing. Those are evidentiary issues to be hashed out later. So we request that the court reverse the district court's decision.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.